the technology. So, we come to our second discussion of Mrs. Dalloway, and we're going to focus on Virginia Woolf's presentation of time within Mrs. Dalloway, because that's obviously a very important aspect of the way in which she tackled the job that she's got in representing consciousness in this novel. So if you remember when we thought about Virginia Woolf's approach and what she said was the job of the novelist, she talked about the difficulty of representing consciousness. And one of those difficulties, or a major difficulty in that, is people's perception of time. And we've all experienced that, haven't we? If you, if you're waiting for a bus, you know, time drags, doesn't it? You know rationally that you've only been waiting for 5 minutes, but actually, especially if the bus is late, it seems like a much longer time than that. And similarly, as the phrase goes, time flies when you're enjoying yourself. Time seems to compress if you're enjoying life. And rationally, we know that isn't the case. We know that on one of those days when you're feeling that time drags, then there are still 60 seconds in every minute, and there's still 60 minutes in every hour, and there's still 24 hours in every day. So different ways in which you perceive time are obviously going to feed into the way that you represent consciousness. And time has a big part to play, doesn't it, in Mrs. Dalloway. You recall that Big Ben, the bell that tolls across Westminster, is frequently referred to. It's frequently there as a way of marking the passage of time. Obviously, that's what its function is. But it's also a reminder of time, chronological time, that is passing through the novel. So there is that sense of clock time, if you like, being foregrounded by the frequent references to what time it is during the narrative as it unfolds. But there's also that sense of internal time, the way in which individual characters perceive time, and that's locked into the interior monologues that are presented to us as readers as we go through. And that, of course, is a very, very subjective thing. So right at the start of the novel, when Mrs. Dalloway steps through the doors, she's reminded and she's, in a sense, transported back possibly 20, 25 years to when she was at Boughton and meeting up with these various characters that we're going to meet later on, Peter Walsh and Sally Seton, etc., when she was with them at that crucial time of her development. Septima Smith is, if you like, locked in the past. He can't break away from his experiences in the war. So in some respects, his experience of time has kind of stopped at the point where he suffered his breakdown in the war. So there's lots of dealings with time, if you like, in the way in which we perceive time, which is expressed through the interior monologues of those characters. But there's also an engagement with the idea of time and the effects of time, which goes way beyond the present moment of this June day in the 1920s in London, and goes deeply into the past and far into the distant future as well. I'll say a bit more about that later on. But of course, if we're thinking about the way in which the story develops, then all of those experiences of the deep past, the far distant future, the individual periods of people's past, all that is being experienced in real time, as it were. That's happening as part of their experience now. So the way we experience time is a complex thing, I think we could suggest, and that one of the approaches that Virginia Woolf uses is an attempt to try to represent that complexity in the way in which her characters react to the passing of time. So if we think about the text and how it's organised structurally, then one thing's very clear and actually very simple, in a sense. The text is chronologically structured. We start with Mrs. Dalloway deciding that she's going to get the flowers. She's woken up that morning, so we know that it's kind of relatively early in the morning, the shops are opening, that sort of time. And we follow Mrs. Dalloway and various other characters as they intersect with her day. We follow her through the day, chronologically, ending up with her sitting on her sofa in her house at the end of her party, in the final passage of the novel. So in that sense, it's linear, it's chronological. It's a one-day event, so not unlike Ulysses, we start early in the morning, we finish late at night. You could also say that it's regular in another sense, in that you could argue, and there might be some argument about this, but you know, you could make a case to say that it adheres to the classical unities. Going back to Aristotle saying that a work of literature, a work of art, had to adhere to this idea of place, time, place, and action. So in other words, the events of a play he was talking about ought to take place in real time. So if it's a three-hour play, the events should cover a period of 3 hours. They should take place in a single location, and all the action should be contained within it. So everything you needed to know should be within that parameter, if you like. So in a way, you could argue that Mrs. Dalloway does do that. I don't know how long you took to read it, but it's a relatively short novel. It's not something that you could read in a couple of hours. But I think if you probably sat down early in the morning and read it fairly consistently through a day, you would probably get through it in about a day. So yes, it does kind of adhere to that. Where does the action take place? Well, all the physical action, all the geographical action, if you like, takes place within a fairly clearly defined area of central London. So that works. And this is where it falls down a bit. In order to understand all of that action, in order to understand the interchanges between the characters and so on, is everything revealed within the action of the play in Aristotle's terms, a novel here? Well, kind of. I mean, certainly everything that you, obviously by definition, everything you know about these characters is revealed within the pages. But there are all kinds of perhaps not entirely clear elements. Motivation isn't completely explained. There's a lot of half-remembered elements, so maybe that doesn't quite work. But nonetheless, it's an interesting point to make, I think, that in something which is actually quite wide-ranging and which delves into the inner thoughts of so many characters and reveals a lot about their history within it, structurally, it's actually quite plainly organised, if you like. Single day, series of events that happen during that day to these characters. During that day, then, we are constantly reminded of what time it is, because Big Ben keeps striking the time. So that element of structural organisation, that linear element, is being emphasised by that. And you might also think about why choose Big Ben? Why not choose some other means of indicating the passing of time? And of course, Big Ben is symbolic. It does stand there at the centre of London, at the centre of Westminster, at the centre of Parliament, at the centre of Empire, in a sense. So it carries symbolic weight as well as, it's obviously a way of telling the time. And there are more subtle suggestions of time's passing in the novel. We mentioned last week the reference to Shakespeare's play Cymbeline, and that reiteration of that fairly common idea about how, you know, whatever state we rise to, you know, whether we're a king or a beggar, we are all going to come to dust in the end. So that, you know, that suggestion of the power of time, you know, time the conqueror, that's an important element there, I think. This is Paul Ricoeur, well-known critic, in his book Time and Narrative. And he's talking specifically here, doesn't mention it, but he's talking specifically here about Mrs. Dalloway. And the point he makes, and I think it's an interesting and subtle point, is that, yes, he accepts, according to that quotation there, that the narrative does progress forward in a linear, chronological way. The narrative is pulled ahead by everything that happens, however small it may be. Mrs. Dalloway goes to buy the flowers. She walks out onto the street. She notices, or she hears, the backfiring of a car. She notices the plane carrying the advertising slogan in the air, and so on and so forth. So all of those things happen. That's pulling the narrative along in narrated time. But at the same time, Ricoeur says, the narrative is pulled backwards by ample excursions into the past. So quite often, something that's happening in the present triggers a memory of something that happens in the past, triggers a reflection on that memory, and perhaps a broader reflection, and we'll come to this in a minute, broader reflection on the nature of time, nature of experience. So those events are interpolated in long sequences between the brief spurts of action. And we've said a couple of times about this novel that Septimus apart, you know, not much happens. You know, people go about their business in London, people meet up, people have conversations. Nothing much happens in the way of major events. And I think Ricoeur would agree with that, talking about the brief spurts of action in the novel. But they are balanced and perhaps even overwhelmed by the representation of memory and the representation of reflection that the characters have. So it overlays the conventional chronological time by a much richer and much more complex experience of time that those characters are going through. So if you think about it, the present that's experienced by the characters is enriched by their memories of the past. And those memories of the past are also intertwined with their thoughts about the future. So, for example, Mrs. Dalloway wonders about her own mortality. Perhaps inspired by seeing that extract from Cymbeline, she thinks about how long she's got to live. She thinks about the prospects for her daughter. So she's projecting into the future, but part of that is triggered by reflections on her past as well. So Hermione Lee, in her book The Novels of Virginia Woolf, makes this point, I think, very succinctly. The past is not in contrast with the present, but it is involved with it. So in other words, the novelist is not saying, as maybe a conventional Victorian or Edwardian novelist might have said, he's not saying, well, that happened then, and this is happening now. So if you read, if you read, say, The Mayor of Casterbridge by Hardy, then the novel unfolds chronologically from a certain moment in time, and there is reference to the past, and the past is going to have a massive effect on the present. And the way that Hardy represents that is by telling us what happened to the characters in the past tense, tells us what's happening, omniscient narrator, and then shows how that past is going to impact on the present. In Virginia Woolf's case, it's much more amorphous. I mean, I suppose it's that It's that envelope that she was talking about, that rather curious metaphor that she used in modern fiction to describe the task of the novelist. She's talking about that that all-enveloping thing that we call life and how that is perceived by characters. And so the past has clearly happened, the past is gone, but nonetheless resonates through the minds of these characters and interacts with the present. It's not a simple cause and effect. That's the point. And so those interior monologues, of which we get a few in Mrs. Dalloway, represent that, what we might call, subjective time. This is not chronological time. This is not a question of the minutes being ticked off by Big Ben. This is how we're experiencing time personally, if you like. Okay. So that's really what I wanted to suggest about the complexity of the way that time is presented in the novel. I want to move into some examples of it now. So think about Big Ben to start with. It's introduced very early on in the novel as a kind of feature, and of course, where Mrs. Dalloway lives, if you have the Oxford World Classics edition, then you have a sort of handy map to show you all these things. So this is on page four, the second page of text, as it were. And this is how Mrs. Dalloway reflects on Big Ben. Bottom of the first page, in fact. For having lived in Westminster, how many years now? Over 20? One feels, even in the midst of traffic, or waking up at night, Clarissa was positive, a particular hush or solemnity, an indescribable pause, a suspense. That might be her heart, affected, they said, by influenza. Before Big Ben strikes, there, out it boomed. First a warning, musical, then the hour, irrevocable. The leaden circles dissolved in the air. Such fools we are, she thought, crossing Victoria Street. So you can see already that that's being, that's setting you up almost for her encounter a few pages on with the extract from Cymbeline, such fools we are. You know, we're governed by time. And governed in perhaps two ways. You know, we're governed in the sense that we are slaves to it. You know, we've had to meet here at a certain time because, you know, that is how it's decreed. But also slaves to it in the sense that time will affect all of us, and you know, we'll, the ideas that Shakespeare expresses in Cymbeline will come to pass. But Big Ben is useful, I think, for other reasons. It symbolises official time. Until quite recently on the BBC, when they gave the time check, you know, Greenwich Mean Time, they would cut to Big Ben. They actually had a microphone in Big Ben, and so what you were hearing was the live chimes of Big Ben. So it symbolised, you know, a kind of official version of time passing, if you like. And of course, the fact that it's attached to Parliament and Richard Dalloway's world, he's an MP, gives it even more sort of official weight, if you like. Another thing that might strike you, especially if you did sit down and read it in a day, is that it has a kind of structural importance. If we were talking about unity of action as a novel unfolds, then, for example, when we get to 12 noon, we are pretty much halfway through the novel, and we're halfway through the day. And Big Ben rings out at that point to remind us. And this is page 80. It was precisely 12 o'clock, 12 by Big Ben, whose stroke was wafted over the northern part of London, blunt with that of other clocks, mixed in a thin, ethereal way with the clouds and wisps of smoke and died up there among the seagulls. And it actually, at the end of that paragraph, repeats that line, the leaden circles dissolved in the air that we had before. And another element that you get here is that you've got other clocks. It mentions that the Big Ben's, the sound of Big Ben is diffused a bit by other clocks who might be slightly ahead or slightly behind Big Ben. Sort of emphasising the fact that time is perhaps not as fixed and as constant as Big Ben would suggest it is, and as it represents in its kind of solidity and its certainty, the leaden circles dissolving in the air. So we have this idea that Big Ben is used structurally through the novel, but is actually perhaps undermined a bit by the way in which other characters perceive time, and even by the other clocks which sort of compete with it. So there's this curious little section. This is on bottom of page 108. Volubly, troublously, the late clock sounded, coming in the wake of Big Ben, with its lap full of trifles, beaten up, broken up by the assault of carriages, the brutality of vans, the eager advance of myriads of angular men, of flaunting women, the domes and spires of offices and hospitals, the last relics of this lap full of odds and ends seemed to break like the spray of an exhausted wave upon the body of Miss Kilman, standing in the street for a moment to mutter, "It is the flesh." Because Miss Kilman's got this kind of religious obsession, and that's what she's talking about there. But in the paragraph before that, we've got actually quite a nice, if you're thinking about how modernist writers reflect upon modern life, or reflect upon urban life particularly, it's a nice little passage there about the alienation of modern life, all these people bustling about, rushing around, governed by the clock, but unable to connect with each other. So it's not dissimilar to the kinds of ideas that Eliot raises in The Wasteland. So throughout the novel, then, we have this sense of a regular time, Big Ben, and the irregular time, the late clock, these other clocks, these ways in which time is misapprehended, misunderstood. Symbolically, you might think that that represents perhaps two states of mind. Clarissa's more ordered, Septimus more disordered, but both, of course, coexisting, and both, of course, having the same status, if you like. We go by Greenwich Mean Time, don't we? And we do that. We have the clocks going back to the week, didn't we? And so we all dutifully forgot, probably, to put our clocks back, and therefore were pleased to realise that we had an extra hour in the day the following day. But it works on the basis of agreement and consent, doesn't it? It's only, you know, whatever time it is now, it's only 11:30 because we're all agreed that that's what we're going to call it. We divide the days up arbitrarily into units and we give them labels. So I think what's being suggested perhaps in Mrs. Dalloway is that you have that kind of formal acknowledgement of what time is, but the way in which people perceive it and the way in which it's actually absorbed by those characters is much more complex. And something we'll go into in a minute when we look at Bergson, the philosopher's idea of time. So what I'm suggesting is that the presentation of time has got a lot of has got several different functions in Mrs. Dalloway. And it's not just a question of setting down the parameters of the day. it's much more subtle than that. It's much more to do with the way in which individuals perceive the passage of time. And if we go back to Virginia Woolf, An Ordinary Mind and an Ordinary Day, that passage, then one of the things that she wants to do, she states very plainly there, is to try to put on the page the way in which people experience life. And we don't experience it, I would suggest, in that very regular way. That would be the series of gig lamps that she talked about. That's the same as Big Ben pounding out the hours. We don't experience it in that kind of organised way. It's much more complex. Okay. So if we think about the different aspects of time, past, present and future, then what we get, as Ricoeur suggested, is that all aspects are presented at the same time. They're presented immediately. And we can see that right from the beginning, can't we? That as Mrs. Dalloway thinks about her party, it's kind of literally a hinge on which her thoughts move. The squeak of the door hinge transports her back to the French windows at Bolton and going out into the garden and recapturing those thoughts from perhaps a quarter of a century before. And reflections on time, as we've said, happen throughout the novel, and perhaps none more so than in the reference to Cymbeline, where she sees the passage from the play displayed in the bookshop. But actually before that, this is on page 8, before she gets to that point, she's also thinking about it. And this is what she says, and it's a kind of rather extraordinary passage, it seems to me. Did it matter then, she asked herself, walking towards Bond Street, did it matter that she must inevitably cease completely? All this, she's presumably looking around, all this must go on without her. Did she resent it? Or did it not become consoling to believe that death ended absolutely? But that somewhere in the streets of London, on the ever flow of things, here, there, she survived. Peter survived. Lived in each other. She being part, she was positive, of the trees at home, of the house there, ugly, rambling, all to bits and pieces as it was. Part of people she had never met. Being laid out like a mist between the people she knew best, who lifted her on their branches, as she had seen the trees lift the mist. But it spread ever so far, her life, herself. But what was she dreaming as she looked into Hatchard's shop window? What was she trying to recover? What image of white dawn in the country as she read in the book spread open? This is the passage from Sibley. Fear no more the heat of the sun, nor the furious winter's rages. This late age of world's experience had bred in them all men and women, a well of tears. Tears and sorrows, courage and endurance, a perfectly upright and stoical bearing. Think, for example, of the woman she admired most, Lady Bexborough, opening the bazaar. The late happenings in the world, of course, of the First World War, and the effect of that on the population. She's got, she's reflecting there on Lady Bexborough, who I think it says elsewhere has lost 3 sons in the war, who are part of the million soldiers that died from this country in that war. So, you know, this is having a huge effect. And it's interesting in Mrs. Dalloway that on the surface, you know, it's this kind of trivial series of events. This woman in London organising a party, you know, nothing very important there. But at various points she reflects upon these actually very important and rather sombre ideas. There's also not just the immediate past and the immediate future, but there's also this sense of a future which is unimaginable, really. And this is, again, another extraordinary passage, I think. This is page 14. And this is when the car backfires and she thinks, well, it might be the Prime Minister, it might be royalty. She's not quite sure, but it's obviously some important personage. who are going past, the majesty of England. But then she goes on to think about what the future holds, and by the future she means the kind of unimaginably distant future. This is almost like a passage from H.G. Wells' The Time Machine. H.G. Wells, who she disparaged, of course. But, you know, imagining a time when London is a grass-grown path, and all those hurrying along the pavement this Wednesday morning are but bones, with a few wedding rings mixed up in their dust and the gold stoppings of innumerable decayed teeth. So, you know, a past where, if we take the Cymbeline reference again, all has been reduced to dust, and nothing remains of people's achievements. And this is something which she comes back to, and Wolfe comes back to too. This is on page 69, when Peter has this rather curious encounter with some sort of a street singer, I suppose, some sort of woman on the street singing, and that leads to that reflection about, and again, picking up on, you know, the pavement was grass. It's obviously an echo of that passage that we just looked at. So going back to kind of prehistoric times, the age of the Tuscan mammoth, you know. So imagining this woman as a kind of every woman representing humanity, but going back literally thousands of years. It's an odd reflection on the face of it to have in the middle of London in the 1920s, in this urban, developed place. But it, you know, it links his humanity with humanity going back all that time. So it's another example of how time has this very large presence in the novel, and the concept of time and people's understanding of what time is. So I'll just say a bit more about that, about the consciousness of time. As we've just discovered, Clarissa Dalloway is conscious of her own mortality, but she's also conscious of living in the moment. She's also conscious of extracting as much as she can. Perhaps, you know, we've got these little hints, haven't we, that she's had influenza. It's affected her heart. She's not as healthy as she might be. And of course, we say influenza, you talk about the flu. You know, I get excuse notes from students saying, "Oh, I've got the flu. I'll be back in tomorrow." Well, actually, if you have the flu, if you have the proper flu, you wouldn't be back in tomorrow because it's a serious illness. And the influenza that she mentions in Mrs. Dalloway had killed literally millions of people across Europe towards the end of the First World War and in the years immediately afterwards. Pandemic across Europe killed millions of people, killed more people than were killed in the war. So mentioning that, you know, very much brings in sort of shades of mortality. So she is conscious of this, and we as readers, I think, are conscious of the way in which these different aspects of time overlay each other and are experienced simultaneously. For example, this is a passage on page 31 of the Oxford edition, where she's getting herself ready, she's getting dressed, and she talks about, she looks at herself, she examines herself. She was not old yet. She had just broken into her 52nd year. Months and months of it were still untouched. June, July, August, each still remained almost whole. And as if to catch the falling drop, Clarissa, crossing to the dressing table, plunged into the very heart of the moment, transfixed it there, the moment of this June morning, on which was the pressure of all the other mornings, seeing the glass, the dressing table, and all the bottles afresh, collecting the whole of her at one point, as she looked into the glass, seeing the delicate pink face of the woman who was that very night to give a party of Clarissa Dalloway of herself. So that idea of plunging into the very heart of the moment and being conscious of that, being conscious of the experience of each individual little splinter of time, as it were, within the context of thinking of time as it unfolds backwards and forwards, is key, I think, to understanding people's consciousness here. This kind of follows up on that point. This is from page 104. Again, thinking about the way in which time progresses, the way in which we divide it up, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, etc. That's very reminiscent, isn't it, of the passage in Modern Fiction where she talks about how the different impressions that you get will make Monday different from Tuesday, and so on. One of her short stories is called Monday or Tuesday, but you know, it's based on that kind of idea. So, nonetheless, hovering over all this, after that, how unbelievable death was, that it must end, and that no one in the world would know how she'd loved it all, how every instant she'd loved it. So, that sense of instantaneous experience mixed with the consciousness of past and the inevitable end. Okay. So thinking about how she presents this, how do you know, if that's her objective, to present how we experience life, how we experience time, then how does she do that? Interior monologue seems to be her favoured method. She presents the unfiltered thoughts of the characters, and sometimes it's kind of lightly interwoven with an omniscient, or well, perhaps not omniscient, but certainly a detached narrator, a third-person narrator. But you have to be, as a reader, I think, quite alert to how she does this. So, for example, if we just look at the opening passage, Mrs. Dalloway would say that she would buy the flowers herself. So that's external narrator, isn't it? Telling us something about Mrs. Dalloway. Next paragraph, for Lucy had a work cut out for her. And we're moving into Mrs. Dalloway's consciousness here. The doors would be taken off their hinges. Rumpelmayer's men would come in. And then, thought Clarissa Dalloway, so that's a fairly conventional third-person narrative. What a morning, fresh as if issued to children on a beach. The next paragraph, what a lark, what a plunge. Well, that's her, isn't it? So we're in her consciousness there. So you're slipping back and forth as you go along. And the third paragraph starts. She's stiffened a little on the curb. She's gone out, waiting for Dartnell's van to pass. Okay, so that's external narration again. A charming woman, Scrope Purvis thought her, knowing her as one does know people who live next door to one in Westminster. So, knowing what her as one does know, well, that's Scrope Purvis, whoever Scrope Purvis is. We never see Scrope Purvis again in the novel. And that's another feature of the novel, that we get these interpolations of thoughts by minor characters. They're almost lesser than that. You know, we see them for literally a sentence, and then they disappear. But they contribute to this constant overlaying of consciousness, these constant switches from one consciousness to another. And what that is what you might call coincidence. Not coincidence, but the fact that they are existing in the same place at the same time and their lives are intersecting in time and space. So there are certain events in the novel. For example, the car backfiring the aeroplane in those opening passages, which several characters experience, and that's the thing that joins them together. That's the glue, if you like, that joins these characters together. That's the single moment where their lives intersect. But even then, you've got that sense of the possibilities that that might bring about. So one of those characters, one of those very, very minor characters, Maisie Johnson, who only appears in this passage, she's the one who sees Rezia and Septimus talking in Regent's Park, and she weighs them up. Both seem queer, Maisie Johnson thought, before queer acquired the connotations it's since. Everything seemed very queer in London. In London for the first time, come to take up a post at her uncle's in Leadenhall Street, and now walking through Regent's Park in the morning, this couple on the chairs gave her quite a turn, goes on to describe the argument that they're having. But this concludes with this passage. She would still remember and make it jangle again among her memories how she'd walked through Regent's Park on a fine summer's morning 50 years ago. So we're projecting into the future. You know, we're imagining at this point, or Virginia Woolf is imagining, Maisie Johnson in, what, 1975, as an old lady, you know, thinking back to, yes, have that curious encounter with those people in Regent's Park. She didn't know who they are. She won't know who they are in 1975, but that's stuck in her mind. So another thing there about perception and how time is kind of elastic. And that idea of time's elasticity is another feature. Going back to what I was saying at the beginning, the way in which we perceive time varies according to the circumstances that we're in. You know, if we're waiting for something to happen, time hangs heavy. If we're enjoying what's happening, blimey, is that the time already? That's how we feel. So time becomes kind of metaphorical. This passage from page 127, after the death of Septimus, shows how time slows down, if you like. The clock was striking, 1, 2, 3. How sensible the sound was. This is Retzia's consciousness. Compared with all this thumping and whispering, like Septimus himself. She was falling asleep, but the clock went on striking, 4, 5, 6. And Mrs. Filmer waving her apron. They wouldn't bring the body in here, would they? Seemed part of that garden, or a flag. So her consciousness is kind of shutting out everything beyond the sense of time elapsing since the death of Septimus, and it's being experienced in a much more in a much different way from sort of chronological time. Just wrapping up now. This passage is about Henri Bergson's theories of time. Bergson was a very feted philosopher at the time, and his thing was about perception of time. He's credited with being the cause of the first traffic jam in New York because so many people wanted to go and see him that it caused a traffic jam. But what he says is actually eerily similar to what Woolf says in Modern Fiction, that passage that we come back to about the myriad impressions and how life shapes itself into the life of Monday or Tuesday. He actually uses the same kind of phrase here. Well, this is actually a summary of his writing. The source for this is on the slide. One moment is added to the old ones, and thus when the next moment occurs, it's added on to the other old ones plus the one that immediately came before. So, in other words, recollection, perception, is a constantly shifting thing. You are now 10 seconds more experienced in life than you were when I started that sentence. So you've got 10 seconds more experience to compare with all the other experiences that you've had. So your experience now is different from how it was just then. That's the kind of thing that Bergson mentioned. That seems to me to be very close to the kind of ideas that that Woolf had about how to represent time. So what she's trying to do, I think, in Mrs. Dalloway and in her other novels to some extent, is to take on board this very complex thing and try to represent that on the page. I think, and I've said this before, I know to some of you, I think she's kind of doomed to failure, really, because you can't hope to get everything on the page. You're still going to be selected, you're still the author, you've still got to decide exactly what goes on that page. But nonetheless, it frees her of a lot of the constraints that a conventional novelist might have and gives her the chance to try and represent life as it is lived, the way in which Monday shapes itself differently from last Monday, you know, that kind of thing. So, thinking about broadening this a little bit and using a passage from Woolf to emphasise this. This is from Woolf's novel. It's a rather curious novel which plays with the idea of time, because the central character is not only hermaphrodite, like Tiresias in The Wasteland, but also extremely long-lived and has had hundreds of years of life. And this passage perhaps underlines a lot of the themes that I've been talking about. An hour, once it lodges in the queer elements of the human spirit, may be stretched to 50 or 100 times its clock length. On the other hand, an hour may be accurately represented by the timepiece of the mind by 1 second. So it's this disparity between clock time and the way in which we perceive time that's at the centre of the representation of people's consciousness in Mrs. Dalloway. And we can say a bit more about this later. Thank you for your attention.